You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
David was a man who ran. After God.
So we're week two into this 8-week series where we'll be looking at the life of King David, and we'll learn more about him as you go on through this series. And today we're going to talk about a very familiar story to you, and hopefully maybe you learn something or are challenged by it. But I would say that if you have never been to church, and this is your first time ever, you probably are familiar with this story. And if you've been in church all of your life, you're probably familiar with this story. But we're not going to talk about that story yet, because I want to talk about one of my favorite things from my childhood. And I should say, when I would hear this opening thing, and not yet, I'll cue it here in a second. But when I would hear this, I would get excited. And let's be honest, even now, when I hear it, I get excited. And depending on what generation you are, what decade you were born, etc., this might excite you as well. But this was something, when I hear the beginning of this and just the whole thing, it just got me excited. So go ahead and listen to this.
In 1972, a crack commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team.
I love the A-Team. Like, I don't, once upon a time, and I discovered this, actually, we were in Atlanta last week, Kendra and I, for a conference, and we watched, like, TV. I haven't watched TV in a long time, you know, Netflix, Prime Video, things like that, but actual TV. And there's commercials. It's really annoying. It is really, really, really annoying. But once upon a time, when TV was like life, there was a thing called reruns, and that wasn't just adding it to your queue. It was a show that would come back on. And I am telling you, there was a span in the late 80s where you could just switch from channel to channel on a Saturday afternoon and watch one A-Team rerun to a different channel to watch another A-Team rerun. And my brothers and I, we would just sit and watch the A-Team over and over. I was psyched when the movie came out a few years back. Actually, it was 8 years ago now. Wow, old. It was good. They actually did a really good job with the movie, too. But I loved it. I loved the A-Team. It was just so much fun. And I'm not sure who I was. Like, I was actually considering, you know, maybe bringing some gear to dress up in. You know, I'm not BA. You know, that's just not me. I mean, except for maybe the bald. I don't think I'm Murdoch, although everybody else might be like, oh, yeah, you're Murdoch. But I'm kind of, like, wavering between, you know, my face. Come on. Or am I Hannibal, you know, the guy in charge? And if you don't know anything about the A-Team, that's fine. But what was so cool about every episode, you know, they sound like they're bad guys when you listen to that. But they were good people helping out, you know, ladies, you know, single old grandmas that had biker gangs attacking her house. Because that's what biker gangs attack. You know, they're always going after the old grandma. Or the Mexican village that, you know, some big guy stole their water supply. And, you know, the A-Team would come in. And every episode, they would always have this montage scene. And again, how many of you have seen the TV show The A-Team? Okay, I'm serious. It's not even on, like, I can't find it on streaming devices. Maybe it's on Roku. It's not, or not Roku, Hulu. But anyway, it's not, no. Okay. Anyway, there was always this montage where the A-Team would find themselves in some sort of weird location, whether it's grandma's house or this Mexican village or whatever. And inevitably, this montage would come up and they'd be like, all right, here's the plan. And they would break into this musical number, and the A-Team would then take grandma's porch and turn it into a way to stop the biker gang. Or they would take the Mexican village and find a way to provide water and stop the big bandito that was coming in. Like, they could always take whatever was there and turn it into something pretty incredible. And of course, they were always like armored and ready for battle. And then, of course, when it was all done, Hannibal would light his cigar and say, "I love it when a plan comes together." Yeah, that's what he would always say. Before, he would say, "Hit it, B.A." And we say that sometimes when we get in the car. That was when B.A. would drive the big van. But anyway, so here's a sample. This particular, we're going to watch a little montage here. They found themselves at a farm. And I don't even know the scenario in this story, but they had to stop the bad guys from hurting the farm, because that's what bad guys do. So watch this clip here of this montage.
The market face.
Frisco bid in at 43 cents more bushel than L.A.
Great.
Where's my car?
Isn't it beautiful?
Lady, a couple bolts, fresh paint, it'd be good as new.
How do I get into these things?
So I'm not even sure what they were doing there, what was going on, but as you can see, they took the farm equipment and turned it into a military fighting vehicle. And they would eventually, win and beat the farm people that were trying to steal the farm rather than buying the farm or whatever they were doing with the farm. But what was so fun about every episode, and of course, by the way, I should be clear that took place in an afternoon. In an afternoon, they just took everything apart and built that whole thing. And a DJ isn't here, but I know that welding usually takes just a few minutes. I mean, it took you guys, 10 minutes to get those platforms up? Yeah, about 10 minutes for the heat, the reason we don't have him on right now is because we're not sure what he has disconnected and reconnected, and we're not into natural gas just spewing into the room. So, sorry, wear a jacket. Next week it should be working. But anyway, it only took just a few minutes, and what was so cool about it is they would take these normal, everyday things, kind of whatever they had, and they always seemed to have, welding equipment. And I don't know where they fit it, because it wasn't in their van. But maybe it was like a pocket knife that opened up into a welding equipment. But they would take these normal everyday things and turn it into whatever they need. So whatever scenario they would find themselves in, they would take that stuff and turn it into something to be used for the battle, to be used for the thing going on. And I want you to understand something. That is exactly how God works when it comes to us. Is that God will take not the awesome tank that you automatically already have and are, but the things that aren't actually that perfect, aren't that exceptional, aren't that everything you need it to be, because we're human and we aren't that way. And God will take those things and use them for his purpose in an amazing way. And our job isn't to be fully equipped with all the stuff that we need. Our job is to offer what we've got and let God use that for him. And so we're going to talk about the story of David and Goliath today. As we're going through this journey over the next few weeks of the life of David, we're looking at David and Goliath. And here's the point that I want you to walk away with today. And that is this: when you're after God, when you're after God, you move. When you hear moaning from the sound booth, you know there's something not right. When you're after God, you move in faith despite the critics. And again, this series is called After God because we looked at last week, David was called a man after God's own heart. He was considered a person that was so interested in God that he was called a man after God's heart, that he was desiring God. And so each week we're looking at what does it look like for us to be considered people who are after God, who are after God's heart. And with David, in this particular story of his life, and again, we're mostly hitting everything. We're going to be hitting some highlights from here and some lowlights, actually. But when you're after God, you move in faith despite the critics. And this idea of the A-team is going to come back into play here in a second. But what we're going to do, if you have a paper Bible, the lights are going to come on. We are going to be looking at 1 Samuel 17. And we're going to be covering like 50, 60-some verses here. If you have the YouVersion app, you can tap on Old Testament. And then about a third of the way down on that list, you can find 1 Samuel, which is where we'll be reading in 1 Samuel 17. If you don't have a Bible, you can just follow along the screen. We're going to do things a little bit differently because we have a lot to read. And this is a story that probably, like I said, everybody is probably familiar with on some level. Whether that's an accurate understanding of the story is a question, but at least familiar with it. So let me kind of walk through this story, a little annotated discussion of what's going on. So let's catch you up to speed, by the way. Last week, we talked about David being anointed as the next king. He wasn't the king yet, and like I said, it's going to take a while for him to actually get there. But God had chosen him and had a Samuel actually come, a prophet, and anoint him and declare basically he is the king. He was the youngest of the sons of Jesse, the smallest. The guy was out he was a shepherd out in the field. So he's kind of the nobody, but he is now the king. And it said that the Spirit of God came along upon David. And we saw that at the very end of what we read last week. Well, then it said the very next verse, which we didn't read, it says the Spirit of God left Saul. And I don't have time to get into the Spirit and how the Holy Spirit worked in the Old Testament. It's a little bit different than the way he dwells us today. We did a series called Three. It's up there on the wall way back where we talk about the Father, Son, the Holy Spirit, the Trinity. So you can listen to that a little bit more on mc3church.org. But all that to say that in the intervening time from last week to this week, Saul has been tormented by this evil spirit. And again, we're not going to get into all what that means right now. But he's like, I need someone to help me. And someone's like, hey, I heard about this boy David that plays the harp. And so why don't you hire him to come and play the harp for you? And sure enough, David came from his little town in Bethlehem. Oh, little town of Bethlehem. And he came to where Saul was living in the palace. And every so often, like part-time gig, it was piecemeal work. He would play the harp for Saul and he would feel better. And so David then, of course, went back to his family and did the shepherding thing. But every so often, and no one really knows exactly how much, but we know it wasn't like a regular deal. And maybe every few months, maybe every few years, he would show up and play the harp for Saul. So you need to understand that because that's going to make sense here in just a moment. So time has passed since last week. 2-3 years later, perhaps. And this story picks up. The Philistines, who are one of the enemies of the nation of Israel, they now muster their army for battle and camp between Tekoa and in Judah and Azekah and Ephes-Damim. Saul countered, by gathering his Israel troops near the valley of Elah. So the Philistines and the Israelites faced each other on opposite hills with the valley between them. So the Philistines are like showing up. All of a sudden, the troops are showing up on this hill. And King Saul, who is the king right now, and again, he was the guy that did not want to follow God with his whole heart. And so the troops are showing up. So Saul's like, okay, let's get our troops. So they line up on the other hill. Now they're kind of facing off across from each other on the hill. And then it goes on and says, then Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath, came out of the Philistine ranks to face the forces of Israel. He was over 9 feet tall. Now, he was actually 9 feet 9 inches tall, depending on what your translation says, but the in American equivalent, English equivalent, is 9 feet 9 inches tall. So stand up for a second. On your feet. All right, now I know we're all far away, and you're going to have a chance to do this as you leave, but if you look back behind you, there is a black mark of tape on the wall. That is 9 feet 9 inches. So just so you can see, kind of compared to your height, compared to Goliath, that's high. And we don't even have, Justin and John are both away this weekend, our resident giants. And so they're out of town on vacation this weekend, But yeah, so that's really tall. So when you walk out and you see that black piece of tape, just get a sense of perspective of how tall Goliath was. Okay, so you can have a seat. So he was over 9 feet tall. He comes out of the troop, stands in front of everybody. He wore a bronze helmet, and his bronze coat of mail weighed 125 pounds. His armor weighed about a shawn, give or take, depending on what I had for dinner last night. So he would carry a shawn, And then it says he also wore bronze leg armor and carried a bronze javelin on his shoulder. So a javelin, a spear here, okay? You with me? The shaft of his spear was as heavy and thick as a weaver's beam, like you do. It's big and heavy and thick. That's what weaver's beams are. So your next time you're like, wow, that's big and heavy thick. That reminds me of a weaver's beam. People will be really impressed at your knowledge of weavers. Weavering? Weaving? Weaving? Anyway, maybe it means something, and it probably does, but anyway, I didn't look into it. So, tipped with an iron spearhead that weighed 15 pounds. Right now in Ignition, your kids are learning the exact same thing that you're learning in here. And in the teaching room, in the lift room, they actually have a 15-pound weight that they're going to be passing around and seeing how heavy 15 pounds is. And 15 pounds is kind of heavy. It doesn't sound that big of a deal, but if it was on the end of a spear and you were to fling this thing, it's pretty sizable. And then it said his armor bearer walked ahead of him carrying a shield. So Goliath is a Goliath. That's actually where we get that phrase. So Goliath is out there. Then it goes on and says, Goliath stood and shouted a taunt across to the Israelites. Why are you all coming out to fight? He called. I am the Philistine champion, but you are only the servants of Saul. Choose one man to come down here and fight me. If he kills me, then we will be your slaves. But if I kill him, you will be our slaves. I defy the armies of Israel today. Send me a man who will fight me. So this is kind of it's not an unusual thing. It sounds weird to us. But, you know, it's kind of like, okay, how are we going to pick teams? I don't know. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Okay, good, you got it, you know. And we do things like that. You know, everybody lines up on the wall, you and you. Okay, you get a pick, I get a pick. You know, or you do what was it called? Potato, one potato, two potatoes. Like, there's different ways that, you know, as kids, we would pick teams, so it's kind of fair. And this is sort of a way that they would do battle. They'd be like, hey, we're going to line up. Instead of everybody getting dead here, why don't we just, you pick your best, I'll pick my best, they'll go at it, and we'll be done. That'll save lots of lives. You be our slaves, we'll be your slaves. You know, think of all the horrible things that could happen. And so it sounds weird, but it was kind of a common thing. And so here is Goliath, the Philistine champion, saying, hey, send out your best guy. And so then I love this. When Saul and the Israelites heard this, they were terrified and deeply shaken. And here's one of the things why, what's going on here, is that if you, like, dude, if you see a 9 foot 9 inch tall man, and he says, hey, I'm the best, who wants to fight me? I have done stupid things. I'm not a fighter, but I have definitely made enemies in middle school of people that were bigger than me, since that was pretty much everybody. And this size is kind of incredible. And so he says, you know, come out and fight me. And when he makes this taunt, understand that there is a whole army there going, oh, wow, he is pretty big. And what's Saul doing? Like, and it's almost a sort of a psychological warfare there. Because he says, if we can make these people question their leadership, question the authority of Saul, if we can make them wonder, you know, maybe this will work. And it's working. Because they heard this, they were deep terrified and deeply shaken. Now, scene change. If it's a Star Wars movie, it's a wipe. Now, David was the son of a man named Jesse. We know David. We met him last week, but thanks for catching us up on the story. He was an Ephrathite from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. Jesse was an old man at that time, and he had 8 sons. We know that too. Jesse's 3 oldest sons, Eliab, Abinadab, and Shimeah, had already joined Saul's army to fight the Philistines. And again, we met these 3 sons last week because surely they were going to be the next king because they were the oldest, they were the best, they were the biggest. And they weren't. So they were already joining Saul's army. David was the youngest son. David's 3 oldest brothers stayed with Saul's army, but David went back and forth so he could help his father with the sheep in Bethlehem. So that kind of comes back to this idea, why he was there, why he was back and forth, helping with the sheep in Bethlehem. For 40 days, these troops are up on the hill. Every morning and evening, the Philistine champion strutted in front of the Israelite army. So one day, Jesse said to David, take this basket of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread and carry them quickly to your brothers and give these 10 cuts of cheese to their captain. Jesse's a smart guy. Here's a care package for my boys. And let's give the captain a little something else too. You're watching out for my boys, right? So he sends a care package and says, see how your brothers are getting along and bring back a report on how they're doing. So David is with Jesse, dad, in Bethlehem, sending this care package out to his brothers and to the captain. David's brothers were with Saul and the Israel army at the Valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines. So they're out there in this battle. So David left the sheep with another shepherd and set out early the next morning with the gifts, as Jesse had directed him. He arrived at the camp just as the Israelite army was leaving for the battlefield with shouts and battle cries. And this is crazy. We're talking 40 days here. And I don't know. I am not an Israelite soldier. I'm not a soldier at all. But here they are. They camp overnight. Then they come back out in the morning. Like, yeah, this time we're going to win. Yeah. They go line up. Yeah. Oh, you know, they're going to and do, you know, hoo ha ha and whatever. And so they arrive at the camp, Israelite army, where do we go? Just a battle cries. Okay, soon the Israelite and Philistine forces stood facing each other, army against army. So they're out there, yeah. David left his things with the keeper of supplies and hurried out to the ranks to greet his brothers. So he's leaving stuff kind of back, going out to the battle lines here. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, came out from the Philistine ranks. Israelites, woo-hoo, you know, the big pep rally here. Then David heard him shout his taunt to the army of Israel. So, we're going to stop there for a second. I think I skipped the verse. Anyway, so as I was reading this earlier, does anybody have another verse right after that? It said the armies ran away in fear. but so there's this idea of him out there taunting everybody, and then they're like, run away from Monty Python. But what I want to do is talk to you from this point on. So here's David. He hears the taunt of Goliath. He is out there on the battlefield with his brother. We've already known that David has a heart. He's a man who has a heart after God. And David hears this taunt. And this is where the story really picks up. Because I want you to understand something. David is about to step out in faith. And is about to offer God what he has. And he is just a little runt, not firstborn, not secondborn, but eighthborn. And we talked about what that means last week. Shepherd boy. That doesn't have anything to offer. But he feels that God is calling him to step out in faith. And as soon as he does, the critics start to gather. The critics start to circle. And I just want you to understand something. There are going to be things, and maybe even right now, God is calling you to do something. God is calling you to step out in faith, to trust Him in some area. And as soon as you begin to share that, as you begin to vocalize that, as you begin to act on that, people, and I'm not talking enemies, we're talking friends, circle around you and start saying, well, wait a second there, buddy. You don't want to do that. How in the world are you going to support yourself on a pastor's salary with a church plant? I don't know. And people start to gather, and that's just one snippet. And maybe you've experienced this. Oh, you don't want to go that far. Oh, you don't want to give that much. You don't want to go to that place. That's unsafe. And people, and I'm not talking, again, it's easy to ignore the enemies. But these are the friends. These are the insiders. And I want you to understand that when faith begins, the critics gather. So we're going to look at four critics this week today. And then in your prime groups, you're going to have a chance to chew on this a little bit more and really bring it into what does that mean for us today. So the first critic is the knowledge critic. And this critic says, you don't know. You don't understand. You don't get it. You think you know, but you don't. Nemo. Like this idea, like you don't understand what's going on. You don't realize. If you knew really what we know, then you wouldn't step out in faith. And that's the knowledge critic, this idea of not knowing enough. And so here we continue on in verse 24. It says, now the Israelites have been saying, do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt him from family taxes in Israel. It's the trifecta. Money, the woman, and no taxes. Like, come on. And so that's what's going to happen for the person that can kill this man. So David, again, David hears this taunt. He's at the battle lines. David asks the men standing near him, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy? Listen to what he says here. Me? My people? Israel? Hello? It's us? Me, the anointed one of God? No. Who should defy the armies of the living God? Because David had an issue here, not with this Goliath guy taunting the army, but his defiance of God. So anyway, and we'll come back to that. So I'm going to go back to that slide in a second, Alexis, but I'll come back. So they repeated him what they had been saying and told him, this is what will be done for the man who kills him. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, why have you come down here? Time out. Eliab is the oldest son. As we said last week, Eliab is the one who would receive the birthright. He was the one that would receive the inheritance. He is the one that should get the best of the best. He was also present when Samuel was like, no, sorry, not you, 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 you, to David, and anointed him right there and said, oh, by the way, he's going to be the next king. So Eliab might be a bitter older brother. Might be there. So he sees David asking this and says, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? Why are you even here? Where are the sheep? You're a shepherd. You're supposed to be in charge of the sheep. You smell like them. Go be with them. He says, I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You only came down here to watch the battle. He says, David, you don't understand what's going on here. You don't know. And that's what the Hebrew word there, that this is written in Hebrew, that's the language they spoke. It says this idea of understanding. David, you don't get it. You don't understand. Don't come down here and try to be like, I'm going to step out in faith, when you don't have a clue what's going on. So just back up. And here is his brother, bitter perhaps, saying, you can't do this. And then David, it's like, I totally could hear this with me and my little brothers. Like, I say something, they're like, now what have I done? Said David. What have I done? Can't I even speak? So he then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter. And the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul. And Saul sent for him. So David goes out, he hears this thing, says, what's going to be done? And his brother's like, you don't know what's going on here, David. But what was the issue that David had? His issue wasn't with him learning or saying, oh, I want to be spectacular, I want to be famous, I want to be the coolest. It was about the fact that this Goliath defied the armies of the living God. And so next slide there. When you have the knowledge critic, they say you don't know. But what was David's response? That's okay. It's not me, it's God. So, that's okay, it's not me, it's God. I want you to say that with me together, all right? On three, one, two, three. That's okay, it's not me, it's God. And you might want to repeat that. Okay, on three, one, two, three. That's okay. It's not me, it's God. Let that sink in. Because when God is calling you to step out in faith, you're going to want to either not do it, or when you do, people are going to come up and start to criticize you. And they're well-meaning, maybe. But you need to realize that if you're stepping out in faith, is it about you? Is it about what you have to offer, what you have to gain, what you have to earn? No, the answer is it's okay. It doesn't matter what the critics are, because it's not about me, it's about God. So, that was David's response to the knowledge critic. The next critic is the age critic. The age critic. This is the critic that says, you know what, you're just too young. You are too young to pull this off. And no matter what your age is, you're too young. You're too young. Or maybe someone says you're too old. This idea of your age, you're just not the right age. You're not able to pull this off. Who do you think you are? Well, when I was your age, I never acted like that. I never did this kind of stuff. When you're getting really old. Interesting thing I heard last weekend. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Charles Stanley. His son Andy Stanley is. We've actually watched some of his stuff. But he's in his 80s. I think, what did he say? Oh, Kendra's not here. He was 80, 85, 86, and he said to his son, he's like, I would just love to find someone who's further along than I am in ministry. as an 86, 87-year-old man. So I can ask him if it gets any easier. And it was just kind of this interesting thing. Here's a guy who's in his upper 80s going, wow, is there someone who's older than me that can tell me how to do it? Because age seems to be this issue. Like, you're too young, you're too old. And that is the next thing that happens here in verse 31 as we continue on. It says, what David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. David said to Saul, now Saul is the king. Saul is the one who's been, you know, hiring him every so often to come and play the harp for him. David said to him, let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. Don't be discouraged. I'll do this. I can do this. Saul replied, you are not able to go out and fight this Philistine. You are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. Sorry about the color contrast. I really need to fix that. You are only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth. Saul says, David, you're too young. I don't know what you think you can do here, but you're too young for this. You're only a teenager, David. You're only in your 20s. You're only in your 30s. You're only in your 40s. And it's interesting, people that are older than 20, as you get older, older isn't as old as old was, you know? There's always someone older. Always someone saying, no, you're not old enough like that. I mean, at, what am I, 40, 41? I'm 41. At 41, like, some people would say, oh, I've never seen a lead pastor of a church at that young age. Okay. Other people are like, oh, what took you so long? I've been doing this since I was 18. And so this age, I mean, it becomes an issue. We have an age issue. People are like, no, you're too young to do that. People might say, oh, you're too old to do that. You can't pull this off. And so that's what Saul said to David. But then David said to Saul, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. We talk about David the shepherd, right? When a lion or bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, watch this. I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. Now listen, read what's going on here. He didn't say, I went after it, killed it, and then took the sheep out of its dead mouth. I struck it, took the sheep out of its mouth, when it turned on me, so it's not dead. He is taking sheep out of the mouths of lions and bears, oh my, and he's taking it out, and he says, then when it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, and then struck it and killed it. He says, your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, and the Hebrew word here is paw, for paw is the same as paw of the lion, paw of the bear. He will rescue me from that, and it's the same word, the paw or the hand of this Philistine. So this guy's like, you're too young, David. And he's like, dude, listen to what I've done. Let me share my resume. But you know what? It's not even about my resume. It's about the God who rescued me. And that God will continue to rescue me from this Philistine leader, whatever, whoever he thinks he is, because he's going up against God. And our God is greater. Our God is stronger. There is no one higher than our God. He understood that. So Saul said to David, go and the Lord be with you. Good luck. That's a nice way of saying that. Hope it works out for you, David. And if it does, I'm cool with that, as we'll see in a moment. But here again, his response was, this is about his going up against God and God fighting for him. So for the response to the age critic was this, that's okay. It's not me. It's God. David, you're too young. No, that's okay. It's not about me. It's not about my age. It's not about being too young or too old. It's not about me. It's about God. It's God doing this. So David's response was 1, 2, 3. All right. Just making sure we're on the same page. So then the third critic we've got here is what I'm calling the tools critic. The tools critic. You're not equipped. Okay, maybe you know what's going on. Maybe you don't know. Maybe you're the right age. Maybe not. But you definitely don't have the tools. You're not equipped to make this happen. And that's what's going on here then as we continue in verse 38. It says, then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on the head of David, on his head. David, on his head. There's a period there. On his head, period. There we go. David fastened on his sword over the tunic. and tried walking around because he was not used to them. Saul looks at him and says, David, okay, you think you can do this, but you know what? You don't have what it takes. Here, take my armor. Put on my armor. Wear my armor to go into this battle. And so he's got a helmet and a coat of armor and a sword over the tunic. And he tries walking around, but he was not used to them. And they hadn't been able to pull it off. He says, I cannot go in these, he said to Saul, because I am not used to them. So he took them off. So here you have Saul saying, David, wear my armor. David, you don't have what it takes. Here, put on my armor. And it's all clunky. David's a boy. We don't know what this, we know that Saul was head and shoulders above all others. We talked about that last week. Saul looked like a good king. David didn't look like a good king. So there's a size issue there. It's me wearing the extra jersey for the softball team, the double XL, so that it fits everybody. Watch me disappear. And so he's trying to. Here's another interesting thing, just for what it's worth, is that Saul, and we're going to find here that Saul becomes a very, very bitter man, a very jealous man. And as I was doing some research on this, the armor of the king is clearly identified as the armor of the king. So that you would know when the king was in battle, you would see his unique armor. And how it stood out. And like we have today in military rank and insignia, you know that one star is not as big as two stars versus two stripes. Maybe you don't know these things. You've got the eagle. There's all these different ranks. And the ranks say, okay, that person is important. You can identify them without even talking to them by the rank that they're wearing on their uniform. Whether they're an Eagle Scout or a Cub Scout. You can identify by the rank. And so here's this guy, David, he might have been putting it not just to give him the tools, but also to be like, and if he wins this battle, everybody will think it's me. That's just conjecture, but it's an interesting thought because this we see that Saul becomes a jealous idea. But regardless, Saul didn't think that David had what it took. David didn't have what it took. So then he dropped the armor and he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand, he approached the Philistine. He didn't pick up a gun. He didn't get a trireme. Is that a boat? I don't know. He didn't get a thing that throws things, a catapult. What's the name for the catapult? Trebuchet, there we go. He didn't get a trebuchet. I'm trying to make context, you know. He didn't get a trebuchet, catapult, you know. He had a little boat in the middle of the valley with no water. He didn't get that either because he didn't need those things because he knew it wasn't about the equipment. It was about the God that he was representing. Now, I also want you to understand, too, I don't know when you think about 5 smooth stones from a stream, but I'm always like, you know, oh, look at that one. It's smooth. We could put that in the rock tumbler and it'll look really nice. We could paint it and say Mifflin County Rocks on the back. You know, like maybe that's what you're thinking. But these were probably like softball-sized stones. Like, these weren't little things, okay? So be clear, it wasn't like this little, like, thinking, like, doink, and it bounces off of him, or suddenly, like, it hits him. He's like, oh, you hit me in my weak spot. I'm going down. I'm melting. What a world, you know? Spoiler, he dies. So he picks up these stones and walks off because it wasn't about the equipment. It wasn't about the stuff that he had. It wasn't about the tools. It was about the God that he represented. So his response to this was, that's okay. It's not me. It's God. That's okay. It's not me. It's God. On three, his response was, 1, 2, 3. Right. He said, it's not about the equipment. It's not about the tools. And again, all of these things, it's important to know what you're getting into. It's important to assess, you know, your age. Like, I'm learning to assess my age. Like, there's things that I'm like, hey, I can do this. I'm going to run. I'm dead. Like, we have a softball game this afternoon, and I have multiple things that get wrapped around parts of me so that those parts stop breaking more. I look like a Michael Jackson video or something with all the different things wrapped around me. Anyway, so I'm not saying there's anything wrong with assessing your age, and certainly tools. You know, it's important to get the right tools, but don't let those things limit your desire to move. Don't let them stop you from moving in faith. If God's called you to do this, if it's what he wants you to do, do it anyway. Don't wait for the critics to surround. Then finally, you've got the last critic here, and that is the ability critic. And the ability critic says, you're not good enough. And in this particular story, the ability critic is Goliath. But in your story, the ability critic is usually you. The ability critic is usually the one that I see in the mirror saying, you're not good enough. Who do you think you are? You can't pull this off. You don't have what it takes. But David confronted the ability critic who said, you're not good enough. Continuing on in verse 41. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked down. He looked David over and saw that He was a little more than a boy. He was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. I love that. You look great, and so I hate you. Come on. Come on. We know that Instagram and Pinterest are out there. Everything's perfect, so I hate you. Anyway, he said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? I looked this up. Nobody knows what this means, and it's great. There was a VeggieTales video made a decade or so ago, and he's like, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the guy that's David is like, I don't know what that means. But anyway, and then it says the Philistine cursed David. And the interesting thing, the Hebrew word for cursed here is galal. Kalal, sorry, it's a Q. That means to be small, to be light. He's like, David, you are little. You are tiny. You are insignificant. You're like a dog, and you're coming at me with sticks, which doesn't make sense. Like, do you throw the stick to the dog? Maybe he's the stick. But it was a taunt. He's like, David, you don't have what it takes. Who do you think you are coming up against me? And he cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. He's like, what? Hello? I know I've been doing this for 40 days, but this is the best you've got? He's not wearing any armor. He's young. He can't fight me. Please, people, please, come on. This is embarrassing to everybody. Don't send this boy out to fight against me. He doesn't have what it takes. He's not good enough for this. But David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied, by the way. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals. And listen to this. So that everybody says, David is awesome! Woo-hoo! No. So that the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. David was stepping out in faith, not for David, obedient to God and saying, God is going to get the glory in this. God is going to get the honor. This is about God, not about me. And so it says the whole world, and all those who gather here will know that. It is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. So Saul, or Goliath, comes to David and says, you don't have what it takes. You're not good enough. And what is David's response to the ability critic? It's going to be different. It could be crazy. Throw you off here. His response is, that's okay. It's not me. It's God. On three. One, two, three. That's okay. It's not me. It's God. When faith begins, the critics gather. And see, what we think is we think like the little old lady on the porch. We think the Mexican villagers without the water and whatever was going on those farms. We think, we don't have what it takes. And the A-team steps in and says, look, you've got everything that I need to fight this battle. You've got everything. You've got a plow and a screen door and hay and I don't know, sombreros. Like, you've got everything that I need to make something. And that's what God does with us. He says, I'm just taking what you've got. I'm taking what you've got, and you've got what I need, because it's not about you anyway. It's about me. And I can make this happen. But as soon as David steps out in faith and says, who does this guy think he is? Everybody's like, whoa, David, hold on now. Who do you think you are? And David says, it's not about me. It's about God. So, let's quickly finish up the story. So as Goliath moves closer to attack, David quickly ran out to meet him, reaching into his shepherd's bag and taking out a stone. He hurled it with a sling and hit the Philistine in the forehead. Some say that a good sling stone thrower could sling a stone at over 100 miles an hour. And so he slung the stone. Stop saying that. He hurled it and hit the Philistine in the forehead. The stone stank in, and Goliath stumbled and fell face down the ground. Just for the record, he's now face down. He's down. He hit him in the center of the face, knocked him down. So David triumphed over the Philistine with only a sling and a stone. Is he dead? Is he going to get up? Well, then David ran over and pulled Goliath's sword from his sheath. David used it to kill him and cut off his head. That's the part we never tell the kids. Here's where it gets even better, right? So he cuts off his head. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they turned and ran. Run away, run away, run away. Then the men of Israel and Judah gave a great shout of triumph. They're like, yeah, let's go. They rushed after the Philistines, chasing them as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron. The bodies of the dead and wounded Philistines were strewn everywhere, all along the road from Shamaharim, as far as Gath and Ekron. Then the Israelite army returned and plundered the deserted Philistine camp. So the battle was won. And they didn't even do the little fight for us. They all ran away. The army went out. Meanwhile, parenthetical thought, David took the Philistine's head to Jerusalem. We're going on a journey with my head. But he took the head to Jerusalem, but he stored the man's armor in his own tent. So he's carrying, and I don't know, dude, I know some people with big heads. I mean, literally, not metaphorically. I mean, I know some people with big heads metaphorically as well. But that 9'9", that's a big head. So David got the head, and as Saul watched David go out to fight the Philistine, he asked Abner, the commander of his army. Don't forget that name. We'll see him later. He says, Abner, whose son is this young man? Now, I need to clarify here, because David, again, was kind of in and out working for Saul. And some say, well, what does this mean? Is the Bible's wrong or something like that? It probably is him going, who is this kid? Like, I know him as David, but why in the world? What kind of cloth does he come from? I like the cut of his jib. Don't know what that means, but he likes it. He says, whose son is this young man? I really don't know, Abner declared. We'll find out who he is, the king told him. So as soon as David returned from killing Goliath, Abner brought him to Saul with the Philistine's head still in his hand. It's like his security blanket now. David, put down the head. Okay, please put down the head. But anyway, he's carrying the head with him. He comes to Saul, which again, you'll see this in the later. This probably plays into Saul's jealousy too, that he's like, he can't deny what's going on. There's his head. So as soon as David returned from killing Goliath, tell me about your father, young man, Saul said. And David replied, his name's Jesse, and we live in Bethlehem. And I want you to understand here, there's nothing special. He didn't say, well, I come from the line of these great, great leaders of Melchizedek and great forebears before us and all. His name's Jesse. We're from Bethlehem. There's nothing special about us. So here you've got David going out in faith, moving in faith. And the critics started to gather. The knowledge critic, you don't know what's going on here. The age critic, you're too young or you're too old to do this. The tools critic, you don't have what you're not equipped. You don't have the things you need to do this. The ability critic, you're not good enough. You don't have what it takes. You can't do this. And David's response was, that's okay. It's not me. It's God. And so when God is calling you to step out in faith, what is your response? Whether those critics are outside or inside, are those critics in the mirror? And I'm not making today about me. It is exciting that next, in 2 days is our 7th anniversary. But dude, there were some very close, well-meaning people in my life that told me many reasons why MC3 could never work. And maybe it won't work. Maybe tomorrow it's over. Maybe you guys are like, it is too cold. We're out. And that's okay, because I feel like for the 7 years, God has done some really cool stuff. Because it's not about me. It's about God. But I want you to know that the critics gather, and these are people, and I'm not at liberty to share, but it was hurtful because it was personal. But the response to be, that's okay, it's not me, it's God. And whatever God is calling you to do, you've got to realize it's not you, it's God. And if He's calling you to do it, He's going to supply everything you need to do it. He's going to make it work out. He's going to provide all that you need. So, the point today is when you're after God, you move. And I underlined move. We highlighted move because you can't sit in faith. That doesn't really require faith. Unless you're sitting on a chair that you think, I think this chair is broken. Hey, we're okay. But in general, and James says this, it's not on the screen, faith is by works. You need to show your faith by doing something. Like, you can't just say, I have faith and not do anything. You do something with it. But you move in faith despite the critics. And that's what I want you to see in this David and Goliath story, a story we know so well, probably. But here was a man that didn't just stand up to the enemy. He stood up to his friends. And that's harder. That's harder than standing up to the enemies. But if God is calling you to do something, you move in faith. If you don't move, you're not doing anything. And if you're doing it not in faith because you got all the pieces together and you got it all worked out, and then once I've solved this, once I have enough money, once we have this amount of things, once I get to this age, once I get this position, once I get, whatever, we add all these little, once I do that, then I'll move. That is no longer faith, people, because you've worked it all out. Once I have this much money in savings, once we've got this, we build these walls all the time. And that's not moving in faith. And then you move despite the critics, because the critics are going to show up. The critics are going to try to tell you why you shouldn't do it. And I'm not saying, I don't care what you say. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. But don't say, I don't care what you say. But you certainly listen, be polite, recognize that there's love there. Sometimes love says, I'm going to tell you some hard things. But then process it. And if this is something God is calling you to do, then you still need to move, even if people are saying, yeah, no, could be risky. So, here's the thing. David said, that's okay, it's not me, it's God. So the question is, how do you figure that out? And I just want to throw out two questions for you, just to chew on. There's more questions you probably need to ask about this. There's more things you need to pursue. But it's easy to say, it's not me, it's God. But sometimes we say, it's not me, but it really is. Or we say, it's God telling me to do this. No, He's not. He is not telling you to do that. I have not heard Him speak to you, but I can tell you that's not what He said. And so how do we answer those two questions? If it's not me, it's God. How do we say, is it me and is it God? So there's two heart check questions before you move. These are important to ask. And again, there probably might be more questions, but these are two. The first one is it me? Is it me? So if we say it's not me, then it can't be me. It has to not be me. And then how do we determine if it's me or not me? Because does it elevate me? If you doing this stepping in faith makes you more incredible and makes everyone say, wow, you're so good, or makes you get that promotion or get that extra money or have your friends go, oh, we are not worthy, whatever, jazz hands. If it's elevating you, then it might not be God. Now, I'm not saying if you follow God, people don't go, wow, look what you did. Then you can do what David did. David didn't say, yeah, look how great I am. He said, everyone's going to know that you defied God. Everyone's going to know what God did here. Everyone's going to see how God showed up. Everyone's going to see how God came through. Because that is elevating God and not you. And if your goal is to elevate you and to get you up onto the higher spot so that everyone looks up to you, then it might be you. So you can't say it's not me. And here in Mark chapter 10, here's a passage. It says, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came over and spoke to Jesus, by the way. They're two of his disciples. The disciples are all gathered around. You'll see that in a moment. They go over to Jesus. So here's, I don't know how much you know about the story of Jesus, the life of Jesus, but this is kind of into his ministry. He's not like brand new. They've been following Jesus. They've been doing this thing for a few months, years. And so these two guys go over to Jesus and they're like, teacher, we want you to do us a favor. What's your request? He asked. When you sit in your glorious throne, we want to sit in the places of honor. Next to you. One on your right, one on your left. Okay, it's cool. Just the two of us, you know. Jesus, is that cool? And then I love Jesus' response. But Jesus said to them, "You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering that I'm about to drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism of suffering that I must be baptized with?" He says, "Guys, do you really want what I've got coming? Do you really want this honor that is who I am? Because it sounds like you're just kind of wanting it for you. And if you really go this far, it's going to be awful." And that's the thing, like, this is kind of an aside. Like, how often do we want, I want everything to be perfect. We're not willing to go through what it takes to get there. We're not willing to do the hard work to get to that spot. I guarantee anyone that you look at as a success most likely took a hard road to get there. And let's not even talk about material, humanistic success. Let's talk about spiritual success. Someone you look at as a godly person, there is probably a valley that got them to that place. There is hard work. There is discipline, personal, spiritual disciplines. But we're like, no, I just want instant perfection. Jesus says, "Are you willing to do this?" "Oh, yes, we are able." They don't really know what they're getting to. And then he says, "Okay, you will indeed drink from my bitter cup and be baptized with my baptism of suffering. But I have no right to say who will sit on my right or my left. God has prepared those places for the one he has chosen." Okay. Oh, by the way, it wasn't just those two guys and Jesus. When the other 10 other disciples heard what Jesus and John had asked, they were indignant. They were furious. So Jesus called them together and said, "Look, you know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you it will be different." He says, "You know how it works. Everyone in charge is the boss, and the boss is the boss. It's good to be the king. The one who's in charge gets to decide how it goes on, and that's the way the world works." And Jesus said, "No, but it's going to be different with you. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be the slave of everyone else, the lowest position. For even the Son of Man," Jesus, "came not to be served, but to serve others, and to give his life as a ransom for many." So the first question is it's not me, it's God. If it's me, does it elevate me? Because if we say it's not me, if it's putting you up higher, then it's probably not God. It's probably you. The second question is it God? How do we know if it's God? Well, there's a lot of big questions here, a lot of things to unpack, but I can tell you this. Is it sin? Because if it's sin, it's not God. Please be clear on this. "Oh, God has called me to rob my neighbor so that I can give it to the kids in Oaxaca." No, he's not. That's sin. And that's what James 1:13 through 15 says. James writes, "And remember, when you're being tempted, do not say, 'God is tempting me.' God is never tempted to do wrong, and he never tempts anyone else. Temptation comes from our own desires, which entice us and drag us away. Those desires give birth to sinful actions, and when sin is allowed to grow, it gives birth to death." He's like, don't start saying this is God that's leading me to do this wrong thing. That's from you. That's from inside you. And if you let that you keep growing, it's going to hurt you. It's going to become sin, and that sin is going to lead to death. And that's what Jesus died on the cross for. So, just two heart check questions. If we can say like David, "That's okay, it's not me, it's God. Is it me? Does it elevate me? Does it make you richer, better, more popular, cooler, nicer, happier, whatever?" Then it might not be you. Or then it might be you. And the second question is, God, is it sin? God is not going to lead you into sin. God is not going to call you to sin. He's not. And so those are two questions that you need to ask yourself before you move in faith. Because we need to move. When you're after God, you move in faith, despite the critics.